Hi, I'm John London. Welcome back to Thinking It Through, a twice-monthly podcast where I explore the reflections and connections that people make to their personal history and geography. A great pleasure in doing this podcast is reconnecting with friends of mine from years ago. And today's podcast is just that. Nancy Nelson grew up, as I did, in Ridgefield, Minnesota, back in the 50s through the 1970s. We knew each other through our high school years and had a few adventures together in our 20s, including a memorable road trip with a couple other buds out to New York City in the mid-1970s. But our most genuine connection was probably along the lines of the social sciences. Nancy's a disciplined and fiercely independent female academic, and she holds a doctorate degree in anthropology from the University of New Mexico, and she's been a professor of anthropology both there and at Wake Forest University. Published in English and Spanish, Dr. Nelson's expertise in navigating and documenting the world of street vendors in Bogota, Colombia, has led to numerous professional papers and presentations throughout the country. Now retired, Nancy lives comfortably in a ranch home in northern New Mexico and tends daily to her current loves, three horses and two dogs. Our edited conversation here shares a bit about her life as a young woman in Minnesota and her physical migration south and southwest. By no means does our interview capture all of who she is, and I'll leave the rest of her story up to you to discover with her. But indeed, Dr. Nelson, as I think you'll find out, has spent a lifetime of truly thinking it through. Here's our conversation.
Did you ring me?
Yeah, I've been trying to call. Yep. Did you fall asleep?
Yes.
Okay, well, wake up. Wake up. What?
I started doing taxes.
Oh, my God. Nancy, thanks for doing this. The podcast, as you're aware of, is just my effort to kind of explore some of the things that I did when I was teaching, really, and trying to have people kind of identify with their own history and their own geography a bit. What I want to do with friends and people I come in contact with is have them explore their own personal history and their own geography as well. So nobody could do this better, I would think, than anthropologists. So this is kind of fun. Yeah, this is great. But let's just kind of start with where you are right now, Nat. So why don't you tell us a little bit about where you live and what you've been up to?
Okay. I live in Corrales, New Mexico. It's Spanish for corrals, like horse corrals. Mm-hmm. I've lived in New Mexico for decades now and just love it. I think because it's so diverse and also it's not Minnesota.
Right. Well, because, you know, as a native Minnesotan looking at the snow here in the middle of April, I understand what you're talking about, I guess. But you moved to New Mexico, in the 1980s?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I did.
And did that come about because of the degree or just because you wanted to move? Or
no, a friend of ours from high school and I, Deb Lean, drove from Minnesota through Colorado and down to New Mexico. And we were visiting a friend of ours who lived here, who we'd met up in St. Cloud.
Right.
And I fell in love with it. He took us out up into the Four Corners area. Mm-hmm. And it's just beautiful, amazing land out here. And it's desert, but it's high desert, which makes a big difference.
Yeah, explain that a little bit.
Albuquerque, and I'm just outside of Albuquerque, is at 5,000 feet. Mm-hmm. Santa Fe, the capital, is at 7,000 feet.
Right.
And then, of course, there are mountains all around us that go much higher. But what that does is make it cooler rather than in a lower altitude desert like Arizona.
Right. Yesterday or earlier this week, Tucson was in the 90s.
Yeah. Right. I know. Right. And it's April.
Right. No, it's going to warm up a little bit. Yeah.
Right. And the area we went to up in the Four Corners is mostly Navajo.
Okay.
Diné. And so there, the population is very thin up there, and there's a lot of sheep herding and really fascinating things that I never ever thought about until I visited New Mexico, until I came here.
Yeah. Like what? What kind of things?
Just how, for example, with the sheep herding, mm-hmm. how they herd the sheep to higher and lower altitudes so that the sheep thrive.
Right.
Up there in the desert. And then they depend on them wholly for food, providing mutton and lamb and wool for the Navajo rugs.
Right.
And so they are part of the family, essentially.
Did you, now before you were in the Navajo country, you had done some work with indigenous people in Latin America? Had you done anything? Had you traveled to Latin America already?
No. What I was just describing was my very first trip out.
The very first trip.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And we went back to Minnesota, and I finished my BA in Minnesota. Uh-huh. And then I came back out here to do a master's and PhD in anthropology. And I came here, and it just worked out beautifully because they had an excellent department here.
Right, right. Do you think that's because of the indigenous folks that kind of are a part of the Southwest, the American Native Americans?
Certainly that was part of it, mm-hmm. but they were also able to hire great professors. And that was motivation for some of them, but it was a very diverse department as well.
Uh-huh.
We had archaeology and physical anthropology and cultural, and uh-huh. and then some genealogical studies as well.
Uh-huh. Were there other places in mind? Did you have other places that you were considering for your master's? No.
No,
you loved it.
I loved it.
Yeah, no, and what's not to love? Like you said earlier to me, do you think it's interesting how people develop an interest in and passion for things, and you don't go after a PhD. I don't imagine unless you're passionate about it. It's just too much work. Let's go into your deep background a little bit, as you put it. Talk a little bit about your awakening into academics. Now, you and I knew each other maybe somewhat casually in high school. I think we knew of each other through Lisa probably the most. But post high school, when you took off for St. Cloud, now that I wasn't aware of things, and you do allude to kind of an awakening to social sciences. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I had a social science course, and it may have been, had a more specific title. I don't remember. But I was quite shy and pretty intimidated about going to college. And so I didn't have a lot of confidence. And in this class, the instructor would call on us, but he would do it by coming up and stepping on our toes under the desk.
What a great technique.
Right. It did. It worked really well. So you couldn't pretend like you weren't listening or you had the answer. And what he was teaching, what I remember about it mm-hmm. in particular, mm-hmm. was that religion was something that was developed by humans, and he's referring to all religions, mm-hmm. as a means of coping with mm-hmm. difficulties mm-hmm. and as a means of giving social cohesion.
Right. Right.
Yeah. That's what stuck with me. It probably stuck more so because he was stepping on my toes.
Yeah.
It really did. And the whole idea was fascinating to me.
Right, right. I
pursuing it after that.
Nancy, tell me a little bit about the diversity within the indigenous people of New Mexico and how that was a part of considerations at the University of New Mexico as well.
The Native Americans here belong to several different groups, and there's Navajo, Apache, Comanche, and Pueblo, mm-hmm. who are made up of Isleta and various other Pueblo groups. Mm-hmm. And they speak different languages, all of those do, and the different Pueblo groups do as well. So there's that huge array of Native Americans. And then New Mexico was actually conquered by Iberian Spanish. Then the Mexican territory took over from the Iberians.
Right.
And then ultimately the U.S. took the territory back. And so we have all those influences going on here.
Right.
And that, I think, influenced the way the department developed. So it wasn't just Native American presence.
Right.
When I came here, there were anthropologists working in local communities, as well as Alaska, Western Africa, Portugal, and various parts of Latin America. So the department itself from early on was quite diverse, and so was the teaching faculty.
Right, right. I would imagine so, just to accommodate all of that, just to be honest with what they're doing, right?
Right.
Yeah.
That's why I came.
One of the questions I have about this search for a graduate school, do you recall some of that stuff? I know it's quite a while ago, but how is it that from somebody stepping on your toes in St. Cloud, you decided that, you know what, I'm going to do some looking around. And did you do that all on your own, or was this after you had traveled to Latin America with your friend from St. Cloud? Or
No, I did it. It was after I made that trip that I went to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
But I fell in love with anthropology and the broad understanding it gives you of human behavior. From that very first toe-stepping professor, we had this friend from this area who had returned to New Mexico, so we decided to come down here and visit him.
Right. You and Deb, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I just fell in love with it. It was just so gorgeous. That's why I looked here first and only for a graduate program.
You know, just getting back to anthropology and your graduate program, you must have been driven by either you could make a decision based on a passion you had, or you didn't give a hoot about making a lot of money, or you knew of some ways to make money out of anthropology. Was there any of that kind of going through your mind as you were checking on what you wanted to do? And was there any particular reason, for instance, you didn't become a business major or a professional in like an attorney or something else? Because anthropology really was, it's fascinating, but it's not everybody raises their hand to go into that. So I'm just kind of curious as to where did you feel comfortable enough, secure enough to make that decision? Was that just something that, come hell or high water, I'm just going to do what I feel like doing?
It came from a place in my development where I thought I was, I had no siblings. And my father was an artist. My mother was a housewife.
Mm-hmm.
I intentionally flunked a class to see what they would say.
Hmm.
They said, you did the best you could. I ended up with this idea that I'm not very smart.
Hmm.
And of course, I had no siblings to compare grades with, et cetera, et cetera. And right. then when I found this, the beginnings of anthropology,
right.
I realized this is something that I'm totally fascinated by.
Yeah.
Part of that, being an only child, is feeds into the economics of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was not being prepared by my parents that you better support yourself. Mm. I was, as everybody said, because I was an only child, spoiled rotten. Mm-hmm. And so worries about that didn't prevent me from following where my spirit was leading.
Yeah, so it's almost like through almost, I don't want to call it benign neglect, but not really being a helicopter parent, your parents kind of gave you the freedom to just almost go get into academia and see what strikes you, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. As opposed to many people who, you know, as you and I both know, that end up doing a lot of things trying to appease some tape they have rolling through their head about what they should be. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, it's interesting. Let's back it up to St. Cloud for a sec, because okay. I think that it was a time when you were woke, as they say, that ideas were making a difference, and your friendships and relationships were making a huge difference as well. You do refer to, in this summary you sent me, you do refer to a dramatic moment with you and your father and Mark at a restaurant. Would you care to go into that and how that fed some things that you were suspecting about America? I don't know, about Minnesota, about your parents?
Sure. We graduated in 1970. You know, 68 was quite a year in terms of social change and civic awareness.
Right.
And when I started at St. Cloud, well, let me preface this with the fact that my mother was born and raised in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was originally from Minnesota. So right. they met and we lived in Minnesota. But what I learned from my mom, and it was pretty indirect teaching, but that what she was raised around in the South was wrong. And so she was, for example, abandoned. One parent died, the other one abandoned all the kids.
Right.
In this 1930 census, when she was 10, I discovered that the person who took her in, who she thought adopted her, listed her in that census as a servant. And so we'd go down and visit this so-called grandmother, and I would hear the N-word all over the place. I mean, she was dependent on the people in the nursing home, and she would be calling them names. And my mom instilled in me that that was wrong, even though she didn't address it with the person who took her in.
Right.
So I learned really quickly from her and not from my father about prejudice.
Right.
And so anyway, when I started college at St. Cloud, my boyfriend, who I met there, mm-hmm. was African-American.
Right.
And I didn't think two thoughts about it.
Right.
I just really liked him for a variety of reasons. And so when we left St. Cloud and came back to Minneapolis and were taking jobs, we rented a house together. And right. on my 21st birthday, my father and my mother decided to take us out for dinner. We were in a fancy restaurant.
Uh-huh.
It was just the four of us. And my father proceeded to, after several drinks, proceeded to put his hands around Mark's neck and force him down in the seat, looked like he was strangling him.
Jeez.
Told him that, you know, he was going to kill him.
Was he upset with the fact that he was just an African-American guy, or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was it. And that we were living together.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the maitre d' came over, took my dad's hands off of Mark, put him back in his seat, and then suggested that Mark and I leave. And so we did. But that was pretty traumatic, to say the least.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That's an assault. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and I was really young. And Mark, we took a cab home. Right. And Mark, all the way home, explained to me why my dad was behaving that way. And he really understood it in ways that I couldn't.
Was Mark from Minnesota?
Yes. He's from St. Paul.
Right. But his life had been that of an African-American kid growing up,
In, you know, very Scandinavian Minnesota.
Yeah.
So he had plenty of experience. And we had, you know, at that time, you know, I began in St. Cloud and thereafter at UNM sort of affiliating with rebel groups.
Uh-huh.
My dad, of course, blamed that on Mark as well. But it was part of my rebelling against what I knew about, at that time, about racism.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And certainly you came to that, younger than I did. You know, I wasn't, you know, I guess, you know, we all kind of woke up a little bit as we got older. But we certainly, you know, and our boy... Yeah, your father from Western Minnesota, and not to you know, be an apologist for that kind of behavior, but what was there, one African American family in Richfield when we grew up? I think maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was just.
They lived on our block, and my dad. This had already happened by then, and my dad had learned something by that point.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
But. Yeah, I never expected it. You know, I certainly saw it in my mother's so-called family.
Yeah.
But I didn't expect it from my dad, and it was there full-blown.
But would you say that a possible root of your empathies or your sympathies or your curiosities have to do with possibly your mother communicating with you rights and wrongs and or friends? I mean, people, you know, can come out the other way, and you definitely were wide open. You had an open mind. Was that mom more than dad, do you think?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay.
My mom would, you know, my girlfriends from high school and I would go down to, don't remember the names of the dance clubs. They were somewhere south.
Remember the prison?
The prison and the barn.
And the barn. That's right.
That's right.
Yeah, I do. So anyway, you and your girlfriends would go down dancing.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
The girls would pull up. Somebody would get their parents' car.
Right.
And they'd pull up at the house.
Right.
And pick me up, and I was forbidden to go to those places by my dad because they were mixed race.
Wow.
And, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And so my mom would help me pack together some kind of dress for the dancing we were doing. So I could leave in, you know, what have you, that doesn't suggest I'm going to a dance.
Right.
And she'd sneak me out of the house.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
That is crazy. That sheds a lot of light. Some of this will not be on the podcast, but now I'm starting to understand Nancy Nelson a little bit.
Right. Yeah.
And that secret bag you brought out to New York with you in the LTD.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, she's got her dancing stuff on. That's really interesting. And you say it's pretty much Ty had issues with any kind of mixed company.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he was, I mean, he did change slightly over the years. He became interested in Asians. But, you know, if you have a really dark-colored skin, you weren't okay. Yeah, and I think part of that, too, is because Minnesota is so Scandinavian. And we've always thought of Scandinavians as being very liberal.
Right.
Well, you know, they're not necessarily.
It did really inform you as a youngster, a relatively young, young woman, to where... when somebody said, you know, here you can start studying about people and so on, you at least brought those ideas that you had learned about diversity into play and had your eyes open to that. From again, like you said, from even your mother talking about rights and wrongs and the way you should treat people. Interesting.
And something else that I'm going to add right here, and that is that anthropology, most of it, teaches that the whole concept of race is a social construct. So that, you know, we act and talk like it's reality instead of acknowledging that we've made this up and changed the definitions, et cetera, et cetera. Over millennia. And that was something else that was really freeing for me. Yeah.
It's almost like it's part and parcel with religion discovery for you. It's a construct. You know, these institutions are all constructs, but religion as a way of, I don't know how you put it, making order of the world, or, you know, I guess I studied it from a sociology point of view. It answered questions of where we came from and where we're going to, as well as reinforce social order for the living. But I love anthropologists. Yeah, I love your studies. Yeah, I do. I've always, it's really interesting because it's always, when you're studying it, to me, it would, I don't know what you discuss. Well, let's start talking about Latin America, and I'll get into it with you once we get into some trips you took. Now, before you got into your graduate work, you took a trip with, as you indicated, with a friend that you had met in St. Cloud, who was a Minnesotan, but interested in Latin America like you were. And then in 77, you say that you decided to travel there by land. Do you want to... talk a little bit about that trip and how that reinforced some of the things that you had started to think about even as an undergrad?
Sure.
Yeah. I am really interested in this journey that you took in 77 with Terry's. And this is before you had gotten really committed to anthropology at the graduate level in New Mexico. This really grew your appreciation for Latin America. So go ahead and tell the story about Terry and you and going to Texas and so on.
Okay. Terry was, I forget where she was from, somewhere in northern Minnesota. And I met her at St. Cloud. She had developed this interest in Latin America and was pretty fluent in Spanish. It was because she spent every winter down in southern Texas with her parents.
Okay.
And we wanted to travel by land through Latin America. And that was as vague as it was.
Yeah.
I took a bus down to Texas and met her there. And then we took a bus to the border. We bused everywhere.
Now, you were 20... all of 25 or 26 at this point, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Yeah.
We went with backpacks, traveled through, we traveled from the Mexican border through Mexico and through all of Central America and had several adventures along the way. I don't remember if I told you about this, but... we in El Salvador were staying at cheap hotels.
Right. I was going to ask you, there's no Airbnb, so you're staying at hotels and stuff. Yeah.
No. Or, sheep hotels, and then campgrounds as well. So we're in a sheep hotel in San Salvador, and Terry met some Brazilian there. I was like in the room reading a book, and she said, oh, he wants to take us out for dinner. He was a soccer player. And so we decided to go out for dinner with him. And he spoke Spanish, so that's how we communicated. And we went out and had okay dinner. Then we got back in his car to go back to the hotel. He was staying at the same one. And he drove us out into the country. Essentially kidnapping us. And Terry was in the front seat with him, and I was in the back seat. We went up into the mountains. He would, you know, go through stoplights, etc. And he switched into Portuguese, so we weren't really understanding. Then he stopped on some little tiny two-lane road up in the mountains. We jumped out of the car as soon as he stopped. Terry took off one way, and I took off another way, and we're trying to keep an eye on each other, but he started chasing her, and she disappeared into the brush. And then he started coming toward me, and I just ran away from him down the road where we come in from. And about that time, another car came along. It was the Red Cross. And so they stopped and helped me. Essentially, you know, it was several men, and they essentially told this guy to, you know, stay away, et cetera, et cetera. He didn't get back in the car and go away, but he did stay clear. And then we called for Terry, and she finally came out of a chicken coop. And was all cut up. And so the Red Cross took us into their van. The guy who had kidnapped us took off. So we went with this group of volunteers, and they were going to a funeral in the mountains. We were, you know, treated as guests of honor because we're from the U.S. So they had the corpse laid out in the middle of a room with chairs around it, and they were saying prayers in Spanish. We participated. And then after the ceremony, the Red Cross got us back in their truck and took us back to San Salvador, the capital, dropped us off at our hotel, and the kidnapper had come back there. So we, we informed the owners. They protected us until we got out the next day. But it was,
From crazy scary to crazy interesting for you, would you say?
I never expected to find myself in a position as intimate as that. And it was the usual, you know, U.S. citizens are so honored that they accepted us. But I felt honored that they accepted us.
As a, as a family.
A community. Well, and it, you know, at this point, too, I mean, what I realized, and this is, I'm going to stretch it a bit because we don't have time to go into all the details, but El Salvador and parts of Guatemala and Honduras are really difficult now, and that's why we're receiving all the migrants from that area. And what I saw and experienced, and even if this was a Brazilian, is that there was a sense of lawlessness there, even then. And so it enables me to understand what the migrants are fleeing. better at this point. I mean, I didn't experience that in anything like that right. in Mexico or Costa Rica or Panama.
So you're learning about Latin America at the time, both, you know, the good and the bad with some of the folks that are there. You do have language, right, though? You are speaking Spanish.
Oh, yeah.
And able to kind of navigate things, which is makes all the difference in the world. You talk even about attending fiestas on occasion once you got into Colombia. How long did it take you to get into Colombia? Were weeks?
Oh,
months?
John, I can't even tell you. It was probably months.
Yeah.
Traveled for a year. We had to take a boat around Nicaragua because they were in the middle of their war.
Right.
Then we had to take a small plane from Panama because connecting into Colombia, there's no roads.
Hmm.
And so those were the two exceptions we made in terms of traveling by land.
Right.
And in Colombia, I had been there before,
okay.
and Terry hadn't.
Mm-hmm.
But we spent 3 months there, and we taught English. I had a number of friends there at the time. And Colombia also has a long history of violence.
Right.
We witnessed some of that, and I witnessed far more when I went back for the dissertation research.
Mm-hmm.
But then we went on. We went to Ecuador and Peru and then over to Bolivia,
mm-hmm.
and Terry went back home from Bolivia.
Okay.
I took a train into Brazil.
Huh.
Met some gay couple on the train.
Uh-huh.
We all went to Rio and spent some time in Rio. And then at that point, I had to go back to the States because my dad had developed Alzheimer's.
Right, right.
So I made it that far by land, and it was fabulous.
It had to be incredible, and it gave you... You know, it's hard to, there's so many details missing. Your story is just incredible to do it alone after your friend leaves, to continue on and eyes wide open to everything going on. Do you think that had your father not taken ill or gotten diagnosed, you might have stayed longer in Brazil?
Good question. I was certainly mature enough to realize that a woman alone is quite vulnerable. And meeting these two friends who took me sort of under their wing
mm-hmm.
made me feel very safe.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And had that not happened, I may have gone home sooner.
Right.
I don't know what I would have done.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was clear I had to go home. So.
Well, you came home then, and eventually found yourself being intrigued with finishing up at the University of Minnesota. You finished up at Minnesota in June of 78 or something with a BA. And then between 78 and your graduate work, did you move to New Mexico?
I went down to Texas and mm-hmm. I worked in Texas for a while. Where Terry was living.
Okay.
And here's a good story. I worked at a bank, and I had worked in banks in Minneapolis.
I think I kind of remember that.
And so, and I've forgotten which presidential election it was, but the bank, you know, had rules about how long your skirt had to be and et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And then they called us in and told us who to vote for.
that's a closed shop, I think. I think that's defined as a closed shop. There.
Right.
With this woman.
And I was just, you know, and mom having come from Texas.
Right.
My not having great experiences there earlier was just totally reinforced by this.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Oh.
So I made a vow never to go back to Texas. And went to New Mexico, was accepted there, and then started a graduate program here.
And then that program, the Master's in Anthropology, did you work, you must have worked with an advisor, or did you have an idea of the program, or was it just general anthropology, or
what? No, I had an advisor, and I had, and he was who I applied to. To get support from in order to get accepted. And he was a Latin American scholar, and he supported my application. I came down and started, and he advised me through the master's and PhD programs both.
Did they did they run almost back to back? And then in that graduate work, were you, how does it work going back into Colombia? Did you go, after your master's, did you go down to Colombia to do your research?
I went down, if I remember correctly, I went down to do probably 3 months of research on the master's program. Or maybe that was PhD program as a preliminary for the dissertation research.
And that was in Bogota, was that? By then, though, you were targeted for Bogota. Now, did you have connections through your school, through your advisor? Somehow they placed you somewhere? Or did they say, if you can speak Spanish, head on down to Bogota? What? How did that play out? How was that developed?
No, as a student, what you do is find your own connections. You have to write that up while you apply for financial aid for the research. And so demonstrating that you have those connections is part of getting that financial backing.
Now, this is before sending an email out, right? You're not sending emails, or are you? Are you
doing?
No, you're writing letters. Are you? What are you doing? Are you making phone calls?
No, it was too expensive to make phone calls.
Come on.
I was writing letters, and I could write so much on a postcard you wouldn't believe it.
Wow.
And my first computer I brought to Columbia for my dissertation research, and it was a Compaq. And so, and then of course that had to be inspected for like 3-4 weeks before I got it.
Tear it apart.
Yeah, so that's what I used.
Okay. Let's get into your dissertation itself. Maybe tell me a little bit about the research that you decided to go after.
Okay. Besides an interest in Latin America, in the graduate work, I became especially interested in economic anthropology.
Okay.
What I ended up focusing on was what was called at that time the informal economy. And all that meant was that it's they're not reporting to the state, and that they are sort of spontaneous.
Would it be the same as an underground market?
I wouldn't, and I wouldn't specifically because of Colombia. I mean, underground in Colombia was drugs. I dealt with street vendors. So they were clearly visible, but it was not, it was total entrepreneurship. They weren't paying taxes, etc.
Tell me a little bit about the vendors and what the size of your study and basically how you gathered data.
Because Colombia has this long history of violence, and also because depending on the population you're dealing with, you know, it's true, particularly here in the States with Native Americans, you don't go anywhere using a camera before you ask permission. Mm-hmm. And you don't take notes about what people say without asking permission.
Right.
And so what I did was go and talk to people, ask a few questions, introduce myself, and tell them what I was interested in, and then ask permission to interview them.
Right.
I would do that on the street, but I would not take notes,
right.
And I never had a recorder. Then I would duck into a coffee shop or something and get, as the Colombians call it, a tinto,
uh-huh.
which is espresso,
right.
And write my notes there.
That took some time, I would take it, to develop some trust for you?
I think it takes time to develop that kind of trust,
yeah.
with any kind of anthropology.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I did do there, and I'm in the capital city, so it's, you know, it's really a large population. I wore a men's suit coat.
Uh-huh. Over,
and it's pretty cold in Bogota.
Right.
And so I wore a men's suit coat over my jeans and shirt.
Uh-huh.
And I put in the breast pocket, the inside breast pocket,
mm-hmm.
I put my notebook and a pen.
Okay.
You know, if anybody stuck their hand in there, I'd know it.
Yeah, yeah.
Then that's why I didn't carry a purse.
Yeah.
That was sort of my uniform.
Huh.
And that's how I protected myself. I
uh-huh.
learned real quickly, one of the keys to safety was looking people in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
When I was on the street, I would look them in the eye, and yet I was taught in Minnesota that you don't do that.
Right. I mean, you've already shared, you know, the fact that you were somewhat of a shy kid, and I'm sure that you just had to go against type to do that. Right.
Well, I really, you know, I interpreted it culturally.
Uh-huh.
And I interpreted in Minnesota that Scandinavians really emphasize humility.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you don't look people in the eye.
Hmm.
You look down.
Right.
And it's sort of out of respect.
Mm-hmm.
But what I discovered in Colombia is that I look them in the eye,
uh-huh.
and that way they know I'm focusing on them.
Right.
And I had one experience where I was coming up to a guy, and it's two of us on a bridge crossing in different directions.
Okay.
He was homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt threatened.
Right.
And I just did that. I looked him right in the eye.
Right.
I didn't move over to avoid him.
Right.
And he didn't do a thing. He just walked on by.
Right. When you're doing that data gathering, do you recall approximately how long you were doing that that routine, establishing that relationship, asking questions when they were available to answer some questions? And you would ask them as they after a transaction or when things were slow, you would get into a general conversation with these vendors.
Yeah, okay. I wouldn't ask anything if there was a customer.
Right, right.
I was there 2 years, and most of that work was just plain ethnographic. But I did do, I had a sociologist as an advisor,
mm-hmm.
and I did a statistical survey as well.
Uh-huh.
And I've forgotten how many people I interviewed in total for
right.
the staff survey.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was like 200.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so I got some stats that I was able to run
mm-hmm.
and develop some sort of overview
right.
in terms of what their background, education, lack thereof, where they're coming from,
right.
what they're vending, et cetera. And then that was backed by the more in-depth ethnographic stuff.
Right.
And what I discovered, just to make all this shorter, is that
Are you giving me your PhD thesis now in like 30 seconds?
That's right.
Wow, thank you, Nance.
2 years and 30 seconds.
Thank you so much.
What I discovered is that there's certainly plenty of people out there street vending who came in from agricultural areas and couldn't make a living doing agriculture any longer.
Right.
And so they're on the street, sometimes with connections to those areas, and so they're able to obtain, you know, pineapples or what have you, to sell. But it ranged from that to really adept entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And also included in that were people who were actually highly educated.
Huh.
Part of the problem was that the formal economy, quote unquote, in Colombia, which is true in a lot of Latin America and other underdeveloped areas, would exploit employees. They would hire employees on a temporary basis for 3 months, and then before they had to pay benefits, they'd let them go. So these guys would have a job, and then they wouldn't have a job, and they still had children to feed.
Right.
Yeah, so people would migrate between formal and informal.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and others would be stuck in the informal because of their background.
Right.
And part of that was trying to escape the violence from the countryside.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And as... You know, in looking at Colombia a little bit, the different groups that I'm aware of, paramilitary tended to be right-wing supporters. The guerrilla tended to be pro-communist or socialist, land reformers, those kinds of folks. Then you had the government in there. Then you have the church in there. You have the indigenous in there. You have all this stuff going on. And did you find that the vendors were made up of groups that would identify themselves that way? Or you would infer that they were affiliated with some political organization?
No, I think it was basic economics underneath everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the two definitions you gave in terms of paramilitary...
Mm-hmm.
Those are, you know, state-supporting military who are acting beyond the government.
Right.
And the rebels were, and there were three predominant groups. And this, you know, was a civil war that went on for 50 years.
Right.
The rebels were anti-government because the government itself was oligarchy. Yeah, so these are generations of families that have the wealth and the power.
Right.
So the rebels were just changed this. It wasn't necessarily socialist.
Right.
But it was, at the minimal, some more representative mm-hmm. democratic
right.
system that they wanted.
Right.
And so one of the things that I discovered, and I think I've mentioned this to you, is that I had two vendors that I spoke to for this entire time,
mm-hmm.
and they were both college educated, and mm-hmm. they were selling advanced degree educational books for mm-hmm. college students mm-hmm. on the street.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, and I had learned this before then, because they told me about their backgrounds. But at one point, two guys pulled up on motorcycles in the middle of the day and killed the male. And then drove away scot-free, of course. What his partner, his girlfriend, didn't know was if they were part of the paramilitary who killed him because he used to be part of a guerrilla group.
Right.
or if they were part of the guerrilla group who killed him because it came in under amnesty. We will never know.
Did that didn't happen in front of you, did it? But like one day you went there and then you were told the story, you saw her and got the story from her about what happened?
Well, she closed the kiosk for a long time. And so then I looked for her and found her, found out what had happened. But at that point, my dissertation director, I let him know. Right. And he just said, you know, you get home.
Yeah, you got to get out of there. There's something going on because you're not too far removed from that just by being in contact. You know, I have a question, just a general question about your life in Colombia, in Bogota. Now, what was that like? I mean, you were there. I'm sure you weren't. Were you on the street for 10, 12 hours a day, or did you find yourself socializing? And what was that like living there?
It was great fun. I love Colombians. They are very outgoing. Oh, the entire culture was just intriguing to me in terms of long history of the music and the food and the way they interact socially. I was not on the street that long.
Yeah.
I would only be on the street during the day.
Right.
Daylight. But there were clubs there where you could go dance, and the dancing and the music was specific to different regions of the country. And so there's like vallenato, cumbia, and all these different types, and it's just fabulous music. I go out dancing a lot.
So you made friends there. You must have had friends that you kind of ran with a little bit there. But eventually you had to pack it up and get home and put all this stuff into some kind of format that would allow you to get a PhD. Was that a long process once you got back home?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole PhD was a long process. Yeah.
Was it kind of a love-hate or hate-love thing? I don't know. I never had that. See, you have so much courage, Nancy. You do things that are very courageous. I never had that kind of courage.
Well, once I got into writing the thing, it became a very specific passion.
Right.
And so it was sort of like, you know, I might as well have written a book.
Right.
And it's the size of a book.
Right. And I'm going to read it. Don't think I'm not.
I wouldn't recommend it.
I saw it on Amazon, and I think it's a little long, but I'm going to read it.
Right. But that was it. Mm-hmm. You know, I came totally wrapped up in trying to communicate this to both the academic society and people who know Colombia.
Right.
I had three advisors, and I spoke with them, and they read, you know, page after page and gave me advice. Mm-hmm. And then I spoke with colleagues who were doing the same thing, except on very different topics.
Right.
And then I'd present papers at anthropological meetings about this and get feedback there. And then I published some of it and got feedback.
Yeah, what a process. I mean, I have in front of me the publications and the names of the articles that you were presenting and things. Each one of those looks like it would take me forever to understand the context of you got it done and you got your PhD and then what you got a PhD. So you're Dr. Nelson, and by the way, I'm sorry that I haven't this Nancy Nelson's gonna have to stop, and it's gonna have to be Dr. Nelson from now on. forgive me
that's quite okay. Dr. I'm still Nelson. Nancy
Dr. Nelson. So did after getting the PhD, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do?
Well, there aren't many options for academics in, you know, in a social science.
Right.
The biggest option is teaching. That's what I tried to do right out of the gate. And I was really fortunate. I received awards for the work I'd done, which enabled me to obtain a job right after I graduated. That job was in Ogden, Utah. And I taught anthropology, and I was hired to teach introductory anthropology, which is really involves a lot about evolution.
Right.
And so I taught evolution to Mormons.
Yes.
And yeah,
how did that go?
Well, it was a real challenge up front.
Yeah, yeah. Did the hands go up? Were there hands? Did people?
Not many.
Yeah.
Not many wanted to engage with me. But they would, after class, go to the church and get debriefed about what was said in my classroom.
Did you hear that from kids? They would tell you, hey, I was at the meeting the other day and was told that that's a bunch of hogwash, what you're telling us. Or...
No, they weren't that direct. They were quite polite. I did hear from some of them who were intrigued about what I was teaching.
Yeah.
That others are, you know, sort of having trouble with this.
Right, right.
And that's what they were doing.
Right.
I'm sure. And I was there for a year, and I was told that by colleagues as well. That would happen. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I bet you had a few converts, though. I bet you had a few people that went, you know what? I think she's right. I think this Mormon stuff is maybe not all all that they say it is.
I kind of doubt it, John.
So from diversity, or from Latin America up into white bread America, Ogden, Utah, right, for the most part, not very diverse. You were there, that program, that award was good for a year or two, or what?
It was 1 year.
Okay.
And then I got a job at Wake Forest in North Carolina. And that is a private university that is very well endowed and in the South.
Right.
And so that was another real exposure for me. The students, they had graduate students. The students were well educated. I enjoyed teaching there a lot because they were well educated.
Yeah.
But we had problems in the department, and I was quite outspoken about them. We had a 51%, I think it was, withdrawal rate of female graduate students. And we had, it was all male faculty who were tenured. There were no women on tenure track. And then one of the professors tenured was having an affair with a student.
Right.
So I began talking about that stuff, and
good for you. Yeah, nice. No pushback.
It wasn't nice. It was pretty ugly.
I bet.
And I should have. I mean, and that's what I learned. I can be really direct.
Right.
I don't lie. I don't hold back.
Right.
But I can be really direct, and you can't do that on a job like that.
Right.
So I was made out to be something that I didn't think I was, but, you know, a troublemaker, obviously. Right. And so what they ended up doing is I had a 5-year contract. They put one of my female colleagues who was not on tenure track, they put her on tenure track. And then they didn't hire her.
So they basically just used her as a placeholder or something, and there was no more tenure tracks available? Is that what you're talking about, or?
I think it was just plain sex discrimination.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So that rather than give her tenure, and there's a lot of reasons why you can't get tenure, but having this long history of only males,
right,
suggests that it's something else going on here.
I wonder where they are now. What do you think?
They ended up, well, one of the things they did when I was there was bring a male in from another medical department and give him tenure in the anthropology department. So that was like, you know, the last straw as far as I was concerned.
Because those jobs in higher ed, I mean, cutting to the chase here, right, are just, they're limited. Tenure track means everything. If you enjoy your work, but you see the writing on the wall, you see what's happening to colleagues of yours that happen to be female, and make some noise about it, it just sounds like a awful political situation. The old guard just kind of, you know, put the wagons in a circle, it sounds like.
Yeah. And that's exactly it. What I did, I quit on my fourth year.
Mm-hmm.
And I quit because I had medical problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just decided this is not worth it.
Right.
Plus, I experienced some of the same racism in North Carolina that I experienced in Texas.
Right.
So I decided to just essentially give up my career and come back to New Mexico.
Hmm.
And I don't regret the decision at all.
Right.
I mean, I'm happy to be here.
Right, right. So, yeah, to save yourself from that situation, yeah, you decided to leave, and you left, and you came back to New Mexico. Now, when is this? Is this like in early 2000s or something? I don't know when this is.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was probably 99, maybe.
Okay. Now, did you retire at 50?
No, I taught here, but the rule in New Mexico is that you cannot advance through the academic hierarchy if you're a graduate.
Right.
And so what I did was contract teaching through UNM in large classrooms here in Albuquerque. And then I also contracted out west from here. That was, you know, out west, it was essentially very close to the Navajo Reservation. And that was a major discovery for me because I was not prepared to teach there. So I learned, you know, about what I lacked in terms of teaching in diverse groups.
Hmm.
And then ultimately what I did was just come back here and retire. Mm-hmm. So I probably retired around 2003 or four.
Uh-huh. Is there anything related to anthropology and to your path from, let's face it, from Richfield to New Mexico? Are there three places in the world that have really made a huge difference to you?
I'd say New Mexico first.
Mm-hmm.
Latin America second.
Mm-hmm.
Minnesota third. And those are probably just because of my prejudices.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was climbing Machu Picchu in Peru.
Mm-hmm.
Some guy coming down who was not Peruvian said, oh, no, wait, he said something. No, I said to him in English, you know, you must speak English. And he said, and you must be from Minnesota. My accent.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Minnesota's always there.
Whether you want it there or not.
Right.
I want to thank you for kind of taking me on this journey. You've just kind of touched on things, and I think in order to get more of an understanding of who you are, we'll have to continue talking informally, and you'll have to fill in the gaps.
I want to thank Nancy for her time and candid reflections about her life and her professional experiences. Like so many in public education and higher education, her impact on her colleagues and students can't be known for sure, but her impact on her friends, I can contest, has been real and truly appreciated. Now that my wife and I have relocated to New Mexico, I look forward to more informal conversations with her in the future, and maybe even a horse ride or two. Nancy was kind enough to recommend a few readings she found worthy of considering, including the novel 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. On the academic front, Nancy suggested three different books that you might find interesting. The first one being Ethnography Unbound, Power and Resistance in the Modern Metropolis. Here, several authors review such topics as social movements, the workplace, immigrants, teaching, and so on. A second book from a colleague at the University of New Mexico, Wisdom Sits in Places by Keith Basso, is particularly interesting given the focus that we're putting on places in one's life. It's based upon work with the Western Apache and emphasizes place with language. And finally, one of her favorites when she was teaching is a text called Learning Capitalist Culture Deep in the Heart of Tejas by Douglas Foley. Well, I hope you found this podcast worthy of your time and interesting. Nancy and I are good friends, and I enjoyed chuckling at various anecdotes, which maybe didn't make the final edit here. But until next time, I'm John Lund with Thinking It Through.